Good morning. This is Maggie Jones, and this is Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from Sumner Madison's book, A Field, and reading more of Eric Epstein's adventures up in Lake Superior. I visited Lake Superior in late May 2014. The remnants of winter were refusing to let go along the coast. The western end of the lake, as far as I could see with 10-power binocs, was still full of ice, broken in places by short leads of open water. The ice still covered well over 99% of what I could see beyond the outer beach of Wisconsin Point at the Twin Ports. I watched a flock of about 30 dunlins and a few pectoral sandpipers several hundred meters offshore, picking at debris on the ice floes. A lone ruddy turnstone was closer in, working its way along the shore. Upended blocks of ice on the west end of the lake were 8 to 12 feet thick, lending the whole scene an eerie but strangely beautiful aspect. By contrast, inside of Wisconsin Point, Alloway and St. Louis Bays were entirely open, and it felt almost balmy. Many common terns were fishing. An olive-sided flycatcher was hawking insects from a bare treetop near the Coast Guard station, and I could hear leopard frogs calling from the warm, shallow bays. Most interesting were the many flocks of wood warblers and others moving through and feeding in the pine forests on Wisconsin Point. 80 to 90% of the birds were in red maples, which were in full bloom, the only blooming plants on the point of any use to a warbler. Many of the warblers had their heads buried in the maple flowers. Whether they were after nectar, small insects, or both, I don't know. It made me think about the scorn so many in the conservation community have for red maple. It's treated by some, especially the pyromaniacal, as a pernicious invasive in many cases, and in some places for good reason. But I suspect that the migrating warblers, vireos, and flycatchers on Wisconsin Point that day would have offered a very different take on red maple, at least under that year's conditions. Here's an Apostle Islands tale. In the past, I'd had myself marooned on the islands to kick my smoking habit. If I was feeling sociable, I'd find a way to get myself to Long Island, not too far off the mainland shore. If I didn't want to see anybody, I'd go to Outer Island. So one fall, when I was grouchy and out of sorts after a long field season, Apostle Islands ecologist Julie Van Stappen dropped me off on Outer Island. I had some task I was performing for her shop, so the Park Service was getting free work out of me, but more importantly, I was further cementing my interagency relationships while striving to improve my health, which were good things. It's late September. This is just before the time when the lake typically begins to turn ugly, but I haven't checked the weather, and I decided to take a long walk from the spit on the south end of Outer, where I am camped, up along the west side of the island. So I am maybe 3 to 4 miles from the spit. I come around the bend on the island's west flank, and the crisp vista and clear horizon of water, waves, and sky I had been seeing have vanished. They've been replaced by a boiling black mass, and I'm thinking to myself, what the hell is that? Whatever it is, it's heading straight for me. It's like this huge black snout working its way down the west coast of the island. So I turn around and I run. I run wildly, which is not easy for various reasons, including all of the deadfalls. So half of my route is in cold water, and then jumping over things that I can't even dream about jumping over these days. Every once in a while, I turn around and this thing is getting closer to me. It's like footage I've seen of dust storms from the 1930s where you have this wall of impenetrable black and it looks as if life on Earth, yours especially, is about to end. So I run and run, passing the big boggy lagoon, and manage to reach the spit. This wall of obliteration is now right on top of me. I get to the campsite. I have a couple of extra tent pegs that I tether my tent to and jump inside just as the storm hits. It's incredible. It kept up all night. An evil night. The world is ending. Gale force winds. I can hear trees crashing. There are thunderclaps exploding right above me, and the lightning flashes are nonstop. Following a lightning flash, there would be an instantaneous explosion and then sometimes a thud as a tree hit the ground. I am lucky that night not to have gotten crushed by a falling tree. Finally, the storm abates and I am exhausted. Somehow, my tent pegs have held. I'm still there and I fall asleep. When I awake again, it's getting light and my surroundings are almost calm. I get up and venture out. The sand spit on the south end of the island is just loaded with migrating birds. It's actually very pleasant, so I build a fire, make coffee, and I'm sitting writing up my field notes and reading. Then at 8:25 a.m. comes around and I pick up my Park Service radio to call in lake conditions as all the rangers and various riffraff who are stationed out on the islands are required to do. Though my campsite is serene, the lake is wild after this gale. From the north and west it looks nasty, but I'm pretty sure that no more trees are going to fall. I have food for probably a week, and I'm not worried. In fact, I like it because I know I'm not going to get any company. But my radio is dead. They gave me no spare batteries, so I have no way to contact the offices on the mainland. So I know at the moment that the Park Service, aware of what a hellacious storm has just passed through, is likely worried when they can't contact me. And I worry about them because I know there's no reason for them to even think about me or do anything on my behalf. Wait until the lake calms down and then come out, but I had no way to let them know. So the lake stays wild, and there's nothing I can do. The radio is dead. Birds are flying, singing, feeding, running up and down the beach. It's really great. I can see waves hitting Stockton Island several miles to the south of my location, parts of the coast that are rocky. There are these geysers, these jets of spray and foam created when waves hit the rocks that must be reaching 50, 60 foot heights. There didn't seem to be any real pattern to the lake's wildness. How would anyone navigate through or negotiate waves like this in a small boat? But the outer island sandspit curves, and there's always one side or the other that's relatively calm. In fact, it's much easier to land a boat on one side or the other of the spit than up in the north end where the lighthouse is, where you could be dashed on the rocks and crushed. So I take a walk and then go back to reading. It's about 10:30. Then I hear a noise that isn't part of the background noise of crashing waves. I know what it is right away. I look out and there's some poor, miserable, rookie ranger in a little bathtub boat, and it's going up and down like a child's toy in a roiled bathwater. He's by himself, because no one would go with him, the boat half disappearing from sight, and finally he gets around the tip of the spit and into calmer, protected waters. He lands on the east side of the spit. Poor guy, he looks shell-shocked. But he has come out just to see if I am okay. In a lot of ways, that really impressed me, even though I thought it was kind of foolish. I gave him a cup of coffee. I think he wanted to stay. One other time, Tom Doolittle, when he worked for the Park Service, came out during a storm to pick me up at the same sand spit. When he arrived, I asked him if he really wanted to head back to shore. This was a storm that convinced me that God, or whoever, did indeed protect drunks, babies, and Doolittles, or at least one Doolittle. It was wicked. Before Tom got us into the sheltering windbreak that Stockton Island can form, sometimes the trough between waves would develop, and you'd be up on top of a big wave with nothing but a void in front of you. And that little bathtub toy of a boat would just come smashing down into that trough. It would hurt your spine, it would hit so hard. At that point, I thought we would never make it to Stockton, let alone back to the mainland docks. There was a point at which I looked around me, and it was one of those times when waves from different directions seemed to synchronize and come together. There was this huge wave that had formed directly behind us. It must have been 15 feet high. It started breaking, and I thought, this thing is going to fall on us and sink this boat. Somehow we just went up the face of another wave, the 15-footer broke apart, and all was fine. Doolittle was like Doolittle throughout, very engaged, but not quite as nonchalant or talkative as usual. He was really paying attention. Thanks, Tommy. I hope you're enjoying the stories I'm reading. This book is called A Field. You can buy it wherever you get your books or get it from the library. Tell them about it. Sumner Matteson is the author, Matteson. And there are many, many more naturalist stories in this book. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.